All right. Good afternoon, everyone. How are we feeling? One more session. Did you guys have a good time with Sabrina? Serena. Yeah, she gets my name confused too. She was great, wasn't she? All right. So, hello, everyone. I wanted to welcome you to Ditch Workplace Drama and Drive Results. I'd like to include personal drama. In the words of my two teenage daughters, it's exhausting. My name's Patrice Ramo. I'm with Cisco, and I have the distinct pleasure of introducing our next guest. I don't know if you guys can tell, but we must have called each other to coordinate our outfits.
We even have the same shoes on.
So funny. Maybe we're like twins from another mother. So I got to tell you, I'm really excited to be here, and I want to add support for less drama, not only in the workplace, but in we need more equity and diversity in our workplace and our personal lives. As an immigrant of a daughter, I've lived the richness of diversity and seen how strong and happy communities can be. And I grew up actually on the other side of Pennsylvania, Pittsburgh. Anybody from Pittsburgh? All right, got a few people here. So you know what I'm talking about when we talk about strong communities, just like Philly. To see the power of inclusion and diversity in action is nothing short of magical, electrifying, and amazing when things that can be achieved together. This conference for us is a blend of real life experiences that we have, practical tools, and peer networking. We all should be committed to inspire each other, make our marks in our personal, in our professional lives, and in our communities. I'm excited about Cy Wakeman. I actually had an opportunity to listen to Cy about 4 years ago. And she is a dynamic international speaker and consultant, a New York Times best-selling author, and a global thought leader with over 25 years of experience in cultivating a revolutionary new approach to the leadership. She's helped organizations and individuals all over the world learn to ditch the drama and turn excuses into results. Cy's professional journey began when she was promoted to her first management position. Rather than forcing ineffective and conventional management practices, which I'm assuming we see daily, into her workplace, she began developing and teaching her employees a reality-based mindset, one that is founded in personal accountability. What she discovered was inspiring. Employees were not only motivated to succeed, but they were also driven to deliver results, adapt to change, and emanate happiness on the job. Inspired to help others to transform their organizations and their work, Cy began consulting and now is training. Today, she visits over 200 companies each year, empowering employees and executives alike to take control of and invest in their work. She was named as one of the top 100 leadership experts to follow on Twitter. Her influence continues to build. Participants consistently rank her programs as the single most impactful training they've ever received. I'd like to welcome Cy up on stage so we can.
Thank you, my friend.
Thank you.
I hope I live up to all that.
Of course you will.
It's been such an honor to share today with you. What a gift for me. I rarely get to attend conferences as well as present, so that's been fantastic. It really was never a career goal of mine to be on stage presenting to anyone about leadership. In fact, I never really intended to be in a leadership role. I started my life out as a therapist and worked with individuals and people who chose to couple up on ways to be happier and more successful. And much to my surprise, I was asked to move into a leadership role. Now, I never really had traditional leadership training. I only had evidence-based training about human behavior. And so when I entered into my first leadership job, I never really had been trained in traditional leadership methods. And for that, I was profoundly grateful. Whoops, have I already broke the clicker? That could be. And in fact, there was something I'd been committed to since I was a young child. I grew up with also a daughter of an immigrant. We had seven kids. We moved into our first like house. And we were so excited because we got our own room, which meant you only shared it with three or four other people. And that's what we called our own room when there's no boys in the girls' room and no girls in the boys' room. And I was rummaging through the closets, and I found in this tiny little town in Iowa this book. And this was a book I found before I knew how to read. This was before the first grade. And I held on to this book. It was the most treasured item I had. And oddly enough, the book was a book of poetry by Rumi, a Sufi Muslim poet in Iowa, in a closet. Isn't that odd? I felt like the spaceship just left it for me, right there. Mm-hmm. When I finally got to be able to read, it was a book I devoured all the time. I still have this book, and my favorite verse in all of Rumi's poetry became this particular quote. Out beyond the ideas of right doing and wrong doing, there is a field. I'll meet you there. And for me, even though I didn't intend to be a leader, I always imagined that there's a place, whether it's work or at home, that could be really different. Out beyond judging, out beyond right and wrong doing, out beyond our biases, out beyond what's right and wrong and rules and policies and procedures, that there just is this place when we go beyond ego, the source of all that judging, where we could connect with high selves and engage in ways that are just totally collaborative and innovative. And that's been really important in my work. So here I was promoted into leadership, and I just really believed that work doesn't have to suck and that suffering's pretty optional. And I just believed some weird stuff like that. So imagine on one of my first days as a leader, and I might just need to, I'm not sure if there's an issue with the clicker, but anyway, one of my first days as a leader, I am my first week on shift, and my first leadership job was in a perioperative unit in an academic med center. And I'm not a nurse, but I was gonna manage a bunch of them. How hard could that be? And if you don't know about perioperative, that's a big word for surgery, where people come to get prepped and have surgery and recover. So I show up for my first week as a leader, and this nurse shows up for her first patient of her shift. She goes into the room, and she begins to prepare the patient for her upcoming procedure. You get informed consent. You let people know what will happen during the procedure, what some of the complications could be, and what recovery will be like. And you're doing this. It's kind of just a routine task. You're doing this based on the information you've pulled up on the electronic medical record. As she's doing what seems routine, the patient became hysterical. Hysterical. She starts to cry. She says, I want out of here. Don't touch me. I want my clothes. Get my husband. I will not have anything done to me in this place. And the nurse is really puzzled because we're just doing some basic things. And so the nurse starts to inquiry and finds out that the patient had come in for a nose job and was being prepped for a partial hysterectomy. Can you imagine? There was a mistake on the medical record. So the patient is hysterical, and the nurse became furious. She took her safety of her patients very seriously. She became furious, and she said, this is unacceptable. I will be back. And she went looking for a leader. I'm walking down the hallway. She said, Wakeman, are you the leader on deck? I said, I am. How can I help? And she begins to share her story. This is absolutely ridiculous. This is unsafe. Admissions, they don't realize what the damage they could do to a patient. They are careless. Somebody needs to manage them. Heads should roll. They do this crap on purpose. They have no idea the harm it could bring. If I did my job like they did their job, I would be fired. But no, they get away with almost murder. And I think she was surprised by my response. Because rather than colluding with her, are you kidding me? This is ridiculous. This is unacceptable. Rather than jumping in and fixing something for her, I knew she was amazing. I stepped in and led. And I said, first of all, take a deep breath. Your brain needs oxygen right now. She hadn't breathed for a while. And I did what I find is really important when I'm with people. I just try and really visualize opening up my heart so that on a cellular level, I hope people understand I really care about them. And then I did something I think that was kind of disarming for her. I asked her the question, if you were great, what would great look like? And that's the question I asked her. And I'm not sure, do you have extra batteries if you want to grab this clicker? Thank you. I asked her, if you were great right now, what would great look like? And this was a surprise to her because she was very focused in what she believed and that she was pretty much a victim and the patient was a victim and she was venting and sharing her story. And I just said, if you were great right now, what would great look like? And it's a very disarming question. And to her credit, she was an amazing person. To her credit, she entertained the question and everything changed. Like a flip of a switch. Instead of looking down and scowling face, she actually, she went to a whole different place in her body and in her mind. She looked up, you could see just the brain waves going back to the inner hemisphere, and she made eye contact with me, and she said, well, if I were great, I guess I'd be back in the room helping the patient understand that this process that discovered this issue is actually a process that's working. It's intentional. We work at least 5 checkpoints before we ever have you in surgery to ensure that you're the right person, that we're doing the right thing. This actually isn't horrible. It's actually a process is working. She said, I could gather the provider team together and we could do a bedside staffing where the patient, we could be all around her and talk through the issues and talk through the upcoming procedure, perfect, and talk through the upcoming procedure and let her know in person that we all understood what we're about to do. She recalled training she had had. She said, well, I could turn the monitor towards her and with transparency have her watch me fix the issue so that would give her some additional trust. See, with that question, she knew many, 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 many things that she could do if in that moment she were great. And as her leader, here's what I did. I simply said, I'm pressing that one and it just to this one. I can get closer to it. I simply said, then just go be great. And she did. Now, this was remarkable. Am I some sort of nurse whisperer that all of a sudden I can take her from like being furious to helping? She went and was great. And I went and checked in on her. Anything I could do? Is everything okay? She said, everything's good. Afterwards, I said, what happened? And she said, I did exactly those things I mentioned, and the patient calmed down, and we restored trust, and the procedure went just fine. I said, what'd you learn about yourself? And she said, you know, I learned that when I was asked to be part of a process that I personally benefit from, where everyone's checking my work, to make sure I'm not making a mistake that could harm a patient, that when I was asked to participate in that process, I didn't show up that well. I thought, what a lovely insight. Now that you know better, you can be better. Now, some of you are saying, but Cy, what if there was a process issue? And there was. In admissions, we had a new medical system, electronic record system. We had 2 things that sounded too similarly together. They were spelled very similarly, too close together on a single screen that leads to clicking errors. So we just separated those out. There was an issue. But who would you rather have working on that issue with you? The self-righteous, judgmental nurse calling for your head to roll? Or the self-reflective nurse that was concerned about our patients getting what they needed? Now, why would this question work? It was certainly not a traditional leadership philosophy that you would have been taught. It's a modern leadership philosophy. Why would this question work. It naturally came to me because of my training in human behavior. But why would this question work? First of all, everyone knows what great looks like. Everyone. If you got Starbucks this morning, you can tell me with a frowny face, medium face, or smiley face if that was a great experience for you. Most of us, when we experience anything, can tell people, was that great or not? This is information we all have. The problem is we use this information to judge other people with, rather than call ourselves up to greatness. See, I know what great looks like. It's what they're not doing. It's what she's not doing. I know what great looks like. It's what communications isn't doing. It's what HR's not doing. It's what, I don't know what they do, but it's what all of those people aren't doing. Unfortunately, we use our knowledge for evil rather than good. See, I need to use what does great look like to call myself to greatness rather than judge others by. It's a much happier, more impactful life. So that's one reason it works. Everybody knows the answer. The second reason it works has to do with how your mind works. Your mind, in this one way, is very similar to a two-year-old child. And in that way, it's that your mind is what we call binary. It can only be down or up. It's like a toggle switch, like a light switch. You can only be in low self or high self, but not at the same time. Have you been around a two-year-old child? Let's say a two-year-old child had this clicker. Now, what's the worst way to get this clicker away from a two-year-old? Just grab it. Once I grab it, I can drag that two-year-old across the room. Okay, because that's all they have. They attach even stronger to it. Now, what's the best way to get this away from a two-year-old? It's to understand the limitations of their mind so that you can life hack it. To get this away from a two-year-old, I don't touch the clicker. I don't even go after it. I compliment them. I go, hey, nice clicker. Have you seen my water? Here's the life hack. A two-year-old, we actually test for this in child development, can't manage two things at once. To get the water, they got to drop the clicker. It's a beautiful part about their mind and yours. Ego, self-reflection. Venting, self-reflection. You can't do both at once. You can't judge and help at the same time. You can't vent and self-reflect at the same time. You can't be in low self-ego and high self at the same time. They're both in you. You got to pick one. And what I do with that technique is I bypass your ego and move you right into self-reflection. And since you can't do both at the same time, I never have to deal with your ego. If I were to say things traditional leadership like, hey, nice clicker, let me give you some feedback, punch the ego in the face. Stop being negative about admissions. Punch the ego in the face. I'm not going to fight with you over a clicker. I'm going to use this life hack to the human mind to just give you a question for self-reflection and try and toggle switch that little switch on your forehead up. See, when I'm in ego, I can't be self-reflecting. And in fact, venting is the ego's way of avoiding self-reflection. Can't do one. We can't do both at the same time. Now, this life hack is a wonderful way to move peacefully through the world for yourself and for others. See, by asking someone to self-reflect, it switches them into a whole different place. So you go from low self to high self. So let's talk about low self for a minute, this ego. A lot of people are like, I'm not the one with the ego, okay? Newsflash. If your mind is fully developed, you have an ego. When you go beyond your ego, you go poof, and you are enlightened, and you disappear because you have no more connection with self. You will no longer exist. So just that second session, we'll back to this session. Your ego is a filter that you wear like a pair of prescription glasses, only it's the wrong prescription. It corrupts your view of the world. It's a color commentator. Everywhere you go, your ego adds something. Everywhere you go, I have an ex-husband who asked for another day with his own children. My ego's like, girlfriend, he's trying to take those kids from you. He's gonna mark that down, go back to the judge, and you're not getting 50-50 anymore. you walk by me and don't say hello. I don't know anything. My ego goes, oh man, ever since she got that promotion, she thinks she saw that in the bag of chips. Can't talk to little people. It's always playing you. One of the things you might not yet realize is that you're not the thinker, you are being thought. If you don't believe me, when you wake up tomorrow, just notice, do you wake up and go, I shall begin thinking now? Or are you already being thought? Now, this pair of glasses you wear that corrupts your view of the world, the biggest mistake you make is you believe everything you think, as if it were true, without question. And when you believe what you think without question, you act accordingly, and then you co-create what you made up. And you don't realize that you have a superpower. How does it work? You walk by me and don't say hello. What do I know for sure? That you walked by me, potentially didn't say hello, I might not have heard you. Quantum physics would say that you didn't even walk by me, you exist on a parallel universe, you're just a projection of my molecular emotion. But well, that's second class, so we'll keep it here. You walk by me and don't say hello, I don't know anything. If I stayed in beginner's mind and I borrowed something from our Buddhist friends, I would just practice non-attachment, conserve energy, move on to add value, be happy and be effective. But when you walk by me and don't say hello, my ego, it's called gestalt, has to fill in the blank. I'm like, oh, see? She can't talk to little people anymore. And I make up a story that you are rude. And when I believe the thought you're rude, how do I treat you? Rudely. How do you respond? Rudely. I go, see, I'm right about crap I make up. So we want to start just disconnecting you from your ego little bit by little bit, because it's scary work. One thing to try and emphasize is if you can't just stay neutral and you have to make something up, try making up something positive. I first teach professionals that being a professional is giving people the benefit of the doubt. Only always. Why? Because we're co-creating. It's my superpower. You walk by me, don't say hello. I gotta make something up. So I will make up that you were deep in prayer and meditation for peace in the world and did not see me. Why? Because I'm doing my part in our co-creation. When I see you that way, how do I treat you? I'm like, oh my gosh, can I sit by you at lunch? How are you in this world and not of this world? Can I just hang with you? You're like, Sai, you're a great judge of character. I go, I know, because I don't judge character. And we have this great outcome. See, the ego is always playing you and influencing. Now, the ego needs to stay angry to stay alive. It eats anger for lunch. So to stay alive, the ego has to stay mildly irritated about stuff, mostly stuff that never happened. I sat beside somebody. She pulled up an email. It said, you're invited to an ice cream social at 2:00. And she goes, oh, this place is such a toxic culture. And I go, why? And she goes, look at this email. I go, free ice cream, 2:00. Oh my gosh. She was reading it through ego. I was reading it through not ego. I'm seeing free ice cream. She's seeing insults. I said, what's up? I said, how can free ice cream be insulting? She goes, oh, you don't know the backstory. See, the ego always carries a backstory. She goes, the HR plans these things when I'm least likely to be able to go. I'm like, I've met your HR team. That would require algebra. They are not going to be able. They're like liberal arts majors. Like, they're not. I said, then don't go. Cover for your team. She goes, well, the other thing, she could not let go of it, is I'm lactose intolerant and they don't offer an alternative. Have you ever been there when your ego just has you? Have you ever said at a wonderful dinner you can enjoy the person you're having dinner with, but you can't because they haven't admitted that you're right yet? That's your ego. There's another part of your brain. It's unlimited. It's your highest self. It's innovative, collaborative, fabulous, full of potential. It's your manifestation of whatever source you believe in. It's a phenomenal place. Meditation, we practice unhooking from our ego and going to the limitless boundaries, or the boundaryless place, right? Your high self is where you'll find places you can see options and have impact. Your low self, you see yourself as a victim, and there's no place you can plug and play and have impact. You can't change everything, so you can't change anything. Now, everything you've been taught about engagement is messed up. Engagement isn't something I can manufacture for you. Drama is a symptom of disengagement. The reason you engage is when you're in, or disengage, you're in ego, and you look, you're the victim, there's no place to plug and play. You can't engage anywhere to have impact. So you disengage. You can't see any options. When you're in high self, you can see a ton of options. Many ways you can plug and play and engage. Engagement isn't from outside of you, it's from inside of you. Impact is a natural craving that when you're in high self, it drives you to your next step. To engage. Engagement is fed by self-reflection. Accountability is fed by self-reflection. And so I put a lot out there. I'll explain more in just a minute. Now, I'm a drama researcher. And what that means to you is I study how much time people spend in drama in the workplace. And it's an interesting topic. I have found that the average person spends two and a half hours each day in drama just at work. These are good performers, productive people. This is an average. People walk around in drama. This is sick and wrong. This place is a mess. I wasn't consulted. I shouldn't have to. This is absolutely a ridiculous way to run an organization. Arguing with reality, which is an argument you'll lose, but only 100% of the time. It's the time you spend in the corner with your colleague figuring out why your boss is such a jerk. It's the time you spend talking about plotting, gossiping, judging, scorekeeping, tattling, resisting change, withholding by, and it's your low self. 2.5 hours a day, 816 hours a year per person. This is our most amazing opportunity in business today. We have come to accept this as a price of doing business because wherever people are, we're gonna have drama, and I say absolutely not. When people started saying in leadership, bring your whole self to work, my team would bring that up. They're like, I'm just bringing my whole self to work. I said, not on my team. I want you to bring your most evolved self to work and bring your most evolved self home. Now, I want all your diversity. I want all your experiences. I want all your awesome stuff because obviously, I mean, I don't have a single client who's a white girl from Iowa. I need diversity, right? So otherwise, I can't serve my clients. But I want your whole self here. Think about if you could recapture 816 hours per year per headcount and put it back into customer experience, conscious capitalism, solving world problems, ending the issues we've been talking about today. Just think about that, and it's completely possible. The clients we work with have workplaces beyond ego that is absolutely phenomenal. And here's the thing, is that you can create it all by yourself. You don't even need anybody else to join in. So that's our drama, is this amazing number. Now, I first started studying drama in 98, but about 10 years ago, about 2008, I did my first formal validated research. And I found that the average amount of drama back then was 2 hours a day. In 2016, I found that it's 2.5 hours per day. It's increased a half hour per day per person. Now, everybody's really quick with the ego story you've all been fed. Oh, those darn millennials. It's not an age situation. It's a human condition. It is our egos. And most of the way we're leading folks, either punch the ego in the face or indulge the ego tremendously. Our current leadership philosophies are indulging the ego rather than calling people up to greatness. And so I said to my learning and development folks, I said, if drama's increasing, what is going on? Aren't you training folks? Aren't you out there like teaching people to be better, more evolved people and move through their stuff so they have EQ and they can deal with the world differently? They go, girl, we're training. In fact, they showed me these statistics that they're spending more hours in training, more courses in training, more money spent on training than ever before. We're spending more on training than ever before, and drama's increasing. I said, don't you ever wonder if what you're training people on is working, if drama's increasing and you're spending all this money on training? When do you question if traditional leadership philosophy you're teaching is working? And I go, Si, we don't do it for the drama. We do it to improve engagement. I go, oh, my bad. Let me look at the engagement progress we've made. Has that thing shot up? And I went to Gallup, and I pulled their numbers, and engagement has stayed completely flat. Engagement's flat. We're spending more time in training, and drama's increasing. I'm like, when do we call it? Because I learned so much in leadership that was completely unhelpful. How many of you learned people need time to vent? You gotta be there for people. Keep your door open. People need time to vent. As a therapist, that horrifies me. People don't need time to vent. It's a dysfunctional, destructive behavior. You have to protect your brain. If you form a neural pathway with venting, a neural pathway is fed with the same behavior that created it. Venting begets more venting. The only way to itch it is to vent some more. Venting isn't sharing feelings. Sharing feelings is one sentence. Sigh, I feel frustrated. Wow. What do you believe is the source of your frustration? Alex didn't give me the information I needed. Do you want to stay feeling frustrated? Is that the feeling you want to stay in? No, I don't like it. Awesome. So if you don't want to feel frustrated, what's one thing you could do to change the situation that's frustrating you? Well, I could just forget about it. I'm not going to worry about it. I'm not going to focus on him. Oh, awesome. I love that. But he shouldn't get away with this crap. Oh, we are focusing on him. So that's a strategy that maybe just thought of, whoo, but you're not using. So what else you got? Well, like I could go talk to him. Oh my goodness, ask for what you need. Just maybe be assertive. That'd be awesome. Why don't you go do that? See, that's therapy and coaching. We would never let you do this. Sigh, Alex isn't giving me the information I need, and I just got to share my feelings. Like, he does this crap on purpose. And you know when this all started? It was 3 years ago when we merged, and he got a different title than mine, and he just walks around thinking he's all that in a bag of chips. And it's really, if you should have seen how he treated me in this meeting, it was absolutely horrible. It's degrading. He walks through the hall with a smirk on his face. See, what you're venting about never happened. It's a story you made up. You'll never be free. As long as you are believing your own thinking, it's the truth that will set you free. This is so important because people go, but Si, just a couple minutes of venting, it feels so good. And I go, I know, so does crack cocaine. But I just wouldn't advise it as like a mainstay in your life. Like, I don't think we should use crack cocaine or venting as a way of coping with things. So where does this leave us as we go through this? It brought me to realize that traditional leadership programs probably aren't working. I suspected that when I first came on and led by people very differently. I came to leadership boot camp finally. They go, Si, you're responsible for the engagement of your team. I'm like, excuse me? They go, you know, the happiness of your team. You're responsible. You're the leader. I go, what? I go, happiness is a choice. Engagement's a choice. Buy-in's a verb. Like, how did I get responsible for somebody else's happiness? They go, no, you really are. It's engagement philosophy, and we're going to bonus you based on their engagement. I'm like, what? I spent 9 years as a therapist teaching people that you can't possibly make another person happy. It's called codependency. We have a DSM code for it. Blue Cross Blue Shield Independence will pay 6 sessions for me to cure you of it. You're like, I think he drinks because I walked loudly in the hallway. I go, girlfriend, he drinks because he's an alcoholic, and you just walk any way you want to. If I were you, I'd walk out. But that's just me. I'm not supposed to give advice. So I went, and I just started suspicioning this, and I started to want to do the research on what are the sources of drama. What are the sources? Because if I could identify the sources after I quantified it, then I could maybe look at our philosophy and what we're teaching to see if we're fueling it or diffusing it. So the sources of drama played out in the following way. 10% was just a junk category of too little to be significant. 32% of all drama is ego. Judging, venting, scorekeeping, judging, venting, scorekeeping, tattling, comparing, arguing with reality. 23% accountability, lack thereof. See, the ego, when it decides it's right, you're right, it figures out who's to blame, and it doesn't do a lot of accountability taking. It is all about avoiding accountability. A lot of us don't understand accountability, so we've taken in our research and we've said, here's the philosophies to change to get rid of ego, here's the philosophies to change. We've done a lot of research with high accountables and what makes them that way. Interestingly enough, this is a surprise to us, 14% of drama is people believing that buy-in is something that the organization needs to do for them. They don't understand it's a verb. They don't understand that it's not really optional, that I can only work with the willing, that you got to be willing. Now, I have 8 sons, beautiful boys. And I, in order to raise 8 sons, have had to get very standardized in my processes in my home. And we look at big data. And what I notice with our big data is about the age of 13, the likelihood of a child being grounded increases exponentially. So before they're 13, I preemptively teach my children how to play poker. Why? Because when you're grounded, you don't get to slink off to your room and play Fortnite. You obviously need to spend more time with your mama to get her values kind of conquered and incorporated. And what mama likes to do on Friday night is play poker. So I teach them to play poker. And then when we're grounded, when they're grounded, I play poker with the groundeds on Friday night, okay? Now, they weren't very motivated. They'd like slink in their chair and they wouldn't participate. And so I had to get some real-time motivation. So I had another rule I implemented that we are playing poker for next week's allowance. That's what you're betting. It's called Double Jeopardy. Now, I taught Charlie how to play poker. Charlie finally gets grounded. I'm like, Charlie, I dealt the cards. I go, this is for real. No practice round. Place your bets. And Charlie was so human in the moment. He goes, Mom, I won't place my bets as my allowance. He goes, before I risk it, show me your cards. I go, Charlie, that's not how poker's played. You're betting on your skill and your cards. I'm betting on my skill and my cards, right? And you gotta be all in. You gotta be willing to do it. He's like, Mom, I'm not gonna place my bets. I wanna see your cards first. I wanna make sure I'm gonna win before I bet. And it dawned on me, this is a phenomenon we saw with so many. They were like, I'm all in, and I love this company, and I'll do whatever it takes as long as we don't have changing priorities, and everything's really predictable, and I have enough staffing, and I have enough time, and I have enough, and I have this, and I have this, and I have this. And what high accountable people know is the only value they add's in imperfect circumstances, that buy-in's a choice, and you make a choice to buy in knowing full well there's a thing called reality. See, high accountables are like, I'm pretty sure I'll never have enough staff, and I'm pretty sure I won't have enough money, and I'm pretty sure things will change, and I'm going to buy in anyway. And that leads us to the change piece. 13% of the drama is still coming from change. We started teaching people change in 1989. What other competency do we give people 30 years to get good at? We have taken change management and taken it off the table. It is a very codependent philosophy. All the responsibility is on the leader to make sure that change is least disruptive to the people. And we say it should be shared so that we make sure that change is least disruptive to the business. And change is full of ego stories that you guys have bought into, hook, line, and sinker, without question. And we question these. How many of you have heard change is hard and even said that to other people? It's absolutely untrue. Change is not hard. Change is not what's hard. What makes change hard is your level of readiness. Now let me explain. Change is not hard, except for the unready. I keep up to date with my cell phone upgrades. It's my competitive advantage. I stay one upgrade ahead of my kids, right? It's how I stay ahead as the parent. Let's say that you are giving out new smartphones, that you need everybody to jump on. It's a beautiful gift from our employers. We get new smartphones, and that's how we're going to do some work going forward. I'm tech savvy. You give me a new smartphone, I go, thank you. I go to the cloud, spend 5 minutes, get it down, switch my phone over, and I'm like, give me an engagement survey. I want to put your name on it because you rock. Thanks for the free phone. Change isn't hard for me, and I am so grateful. The person who has their flip phone, the same one they've had since high school, the one that skipped 27 upgrades, is in a fetal position asking when super user training is. See, if change were hard, it'd be equally hard for both of us. If change is the thing that's hard, it would be equally hard for both of us, but it is not equally hard for both of us. It's just hard for one of us. Change is only hard for the unready. And most of what we do is we slow down, coddle the person who's unready, and tell all those people who are ready for change, hold up, wait for it. Engagement is another issue that we have that I don't have time to talk about today, but engagement without accountability, this over-rotation on engagement creates entitlement. And maybe you've noticed. And this war on talent is fueling some of that. But let's get to what we can control today, some things I want you to know about. I came to believe that the leader's role is not to inspire or motivate anyone. I don't believe one person can inspire another person. I believe inspiration is a choice, motivation's a choice. I will give the same talk. Some of you will be motivated, some not. It's not my talk. If it was my talk, I'd motivate everybody. But it's you that decide whether this resonates or not. So I don't think leaders should be in the business of inspiring people. I don't think it's something, it's even possible. I do think that leaders should be in charge of eliminating drama from the workplace. Drama is emotional waste. How do you get rid of waste from the workplace? With a good process. How many of you are involved in lean and process improvements? And yeah, we're going after, if I send on the manufacturing line, there's 3 seconds we can save per 100 units. We can save 3 seconds. You guys will be giving acrylic trophies to everybody. And I'm telling you, you can save 2.5 hours per person per day. The way you get rid of waste is with a good process. The way you get rid of emotional waste is with a good mental process. Leaders are in charge of teaching and facilitating and holding people accountable to good mental processes. What's a good mental process? A question for self-reflection, like what does great look like? Imagine the next time that nurse runs into something in the room and her first inclination is, this is BS. I'm going to find Wakeman and she's going to ask me what great would look like. And I'm going to skip Wakeman and just go back in that room and be great. See, my leadership will live within them as a mental process. Now, why will people use it? Why will they not throw it away like all the other leadership stuff we give them? Okay? Why will they use it? Evolution favors what feels good and what works. And when we get you in touch with high self, free from the grasp of ego, it feels amazing, empowering, impactful. It's aligned with the natural order of things. It works. Once people discover this field out there, they will go visit it as often as they can. So I think with this new role as a leader, we've got to look at a few things differently. And the first thing you have to look at and understand is how people react viscerally to stuff that's going on. If the going gets tough and you're human, one of your first defaults is fantasize about quitting. Big announcement at work, fantasize about Walmart greeter guy job. Right? New strategies, do more with less. You're like, check my retirement. It's our first reaction. 71% of Americans, according to Gallup, quit their jobs every single day. Problem is, they keep coming to work and getting a paycheck. When you quit, it doesn't feel good. The ego hates it when you don't feel good about yourself. So right after you step down, it steps in and justifies why you had to, and you get involved in something called BMW driving, bitching, moaning, and whining. When you're venting, know this for sure, you recently stepped down. It's the big cover-up. What are we venting about? When we get together and we sympathize with one another, we are venting about the fact that something in reality needs to change. I need a better leader. I need something outside to change. I need people, other departments to cooperate more. The whole list is always, I'm all in, but these other people have a problem. We bond together. We go find a leader for help. We go, hey, we've all been talking, but everyone's scared to come to you. I just wanted you to know. Here's a list of terroristic demands that if you could just change reality a bit, we would sign up and give you the gift of our work. And here's the problem with that. Here's the problem with that, is that it's not about changing reality, it's about changing the level of your frequency, your consciousness, the part of your brain you're using to view reality. It's about changing your mindset. Great leaders don't coddle people or help them change reality. Great leaders help people get more skillful so that they can operate more freely in their current reality. When people say to me, Sai, these jobs are undoable, I go, that's probably true. Given your current skill set, your current approach, and your current level of willingness, they seem undoable. The jobs aren't going to change. They're just going to increase in complexity. You can grow with it. Now, I will give you an example. I worked in a large medical, academic medical center. We had a great year of capital growth, capital fundraising. We had enough money to build a heart center and an ambulatory surgery center all on our campus. What that meant was for a couple of years, we were going to play a mad game of Tetris. Has anybody done facility planning Tetris games? You move here, we'll move them here, then they can move over here, then you'll come back here. Like, HR and this game, this facilities plan, was slated to move three times. And you know what? We were fine with it. Should you move patients on ventilators or people in HR? We're like, we get it. We'll move more than our fair share. We moved the first time to the old nurses' college. It's kind of quaint. They were doing construction above us. We all got headaches. I called employee health. I go, it's weird. We all have headaches. They came in and they took our blood. They left us a pamphlet on lead poisoning and moved us in the middle of the night. My team was a little upset about the loss of IQ points. Like, they're like, to cheer them up, I got them cool new temporary offices. They could look and see our offices being built in the heart center. Unfortunately, that gave them a front row seat to see the offices being built and then tore down because we found out they were built on Native American burial grounds that weren't documented. And we did the right thing. We partnered with the Lakota Nation and found a way to honor and restore the land of their ancestors. They found out after 18 months they're going to move for the fifth time in 18 months. And I walked in, they had torches and pitchforks. They're like, I'm not moving. I'm like, come on, turn those fountains upside down. They're like, it won't work, Sai. I go, what do you want me to do? They're like, go stop the moving. I'm like, what do you mean? They're like, go stop the moving. Go to the CEO, tell him to stop moving us, change our reality. And I fell for it. I thought, this is ridiculous. They were saying things like, what about our engagement? We don't have the tools to do our job. We live out of boxes. If we had a best friend at work, they'd never be able to find us. And they opened up the disaster recovery plan. They go, Sai, we're not even on it anymore. If the building blows, no one's even going to come for us. I'm like, I will go represent. So I went up to the CEO suite, the glass hallway. I got to the administrative support person. I demanded to see Doug Johnson. Doug and I are going to have a come to Jesus. My people are suffering. I want him up here now. And I was surprised. She picked up the phone, started dialing. She's like, yes, get up here right away. She's right here. She needs to see you. Now, what I didn't know is that I'd gotten promoted way too early in my career. And my mentors were a little worried that I would commit career suicide. So they put a safety net in place. They told the support person, if I ever was up there demanding to see Doug Johnson, to call a mentor. So I'm up there like, yeah, get him up here. I turn around, I'm like, Sister Mary Catherine, what are you always doing here when I'm trying to see Doug? Never really got it. She goes, Sai, what's going on? I go, my people are suffering. She goes, your people are suffering? I go, yeah. She goes, why would they be suffering? I go, so we moved. We're moving for the fifth time. We move all the time. And she goes, oh, I know that's your reality. I'm just wondering why they're suffering. Because we move all the time. Grasshopper. And she's like, I know that's your reality. Why are they suffering? And I'm like, dang it. The reason they were suffering is they hadn't yet gotten mobile. Not that we moved all the time. So I went back and worked with my team to get mobile so that moving didn't hurt. Does that make sense? Their natural state was innovation once the drama was gone. This woman taught me to separate out reality from suffering. Suffering is optional. Reality isn't so optional. Two ways to go through the day, joy or misery. But your circumstances aren't the reasons you can't succeed. They're just the reality in which you must succeed. I started to use these questions for self-reflection when people came to me, like, all the time. Sai, do you have a minute? IT is screwing our life up. They can't do anything right. The conversion went south. I'm like, oh my gosh, Tammy, I'm thrilled that you're in my office sharing your love and concern for our colleagues in IT. In my company, we stopped judging, started helping. On the back of your badge, you have the question, how can I help? It's a non-negotiable. You do not judge colleagues. You help. You knock that off. We do not need that low part of you at work right now. And I said, Tammy, that sounds like they had a horrible weekend. What did you do to help? She's like, I'm in here telling you. I go, let me just, with all the love of my heart, that's not helpful. Do you have your badge? Yes. Great, let's go find Karen. Karen, Tammy was in my office just now sharing love and concern. It sounds like your team had a horrible weekend, and she has a question for you. Go ahead, Tammy. Tammy's like, how can I help? Karen had great answers. When you tell your team business requirement meetings aren't mandatory, not helpful. See, she was venting to cover up her most recent step down. She didn't tell them what systems were connected, but she could vent about the conversion. And I want people to feel better about themselves. My big bottom line is stop judging, start helping. And you don't need to be empowered by somebody else. Empowerment is just stepping in to the power you already have. You guys already know your ego's not your amigo, hopefully. And that venting is the ego's way of avoiding self-reflection. And self-reflection is the foundation of accountability, as I said. And the reason your ego avoids self-reflection is because it's accountability is really the death to the ego. So let's give you a couple more examples as we move forward, because self-reflection is the ultimate drama diffuser. It's the ultimate way out of ego. I've already taught you some questions for self-reflection. What could I do to help and what's great look like? But there's one more that will help you loosen the grip that your ego has on you. And that is all about understanding your suffering's optional. So that one question is, what do I know for sure? I once had a boss who I was convinced was a micromanager. But when I questioned my thinking, what do I know for sure? I found out he was somebody who preferred more detail than I liked to give. And it freed me up. It was wonderful. I found out that I can't trust my ego. My ego was telling me he's trying to get you fired and he's setting you up and you're gonna get fired and your kid's gonna drop out of med school and then kids in Uganda that he wanted to work with are gonna die. That's what my ego wanted me to believe. But my reality was he called twice a day and checked my project status. You have a day that's busy? Your ego makes it crazy. How's the day? Crazy! I go, well, it's busy, but what made it crazy? I added that. Well, that's not helpful. Every year I go on a hike in Mexico with a team of phenomenal leaders. I'm standing on the mountain one year with them, and I'm overlooking the valley, and I'm just overcome with gratitude. It's like I've won life's lottery. I'm so blissful that I have the coolest job in the world. They pay me to hike in beautiful mountains and talk leadership with super successful, cool people. Like, dang it. Awesome. I wanted to remember that moment forever. I thought to myself, if I die tomorrow, I'm good. I'm in blissful state. I'm aware of my reality. And then I turn to walk ahead, and all that bliss crashes, gone. I suddenly hate my job. I can't believe they pay me to do this crap. What changed in a second from bliss to hate? I look ahead and there's a rope on the path. But what I saw was a snake. The minute I saw something squiggling on the path, I thought, that's the snake, and my whole life changed with one thought. My respiration went up, my need to urinate went up. I was freaking out. I knew it was a snake. I knew I was going to get bitten. I knew I was going to die on the mountain. I knew I'd be medevaced off in the Mexican chopper. I knew all of it. I'm trying to think of a plan because I don't know what to do if I have a snake bite. I don't know what to do. And then I remembered a John Wayne movie I saw once. He pulled out his pocket knife and he cut an X in his hand where he had gotten bit and sucked the venom and the blood and spit it out, saved his own life. It's now my plan. Few modifications. I'm going to get bit in the ankle, I surmise. So I reach for my pocket knife. I'm like, okay, if I get bit, I just got a cut in my ankle. I can do it. I'm brave. And I just got to suck my ankle. Crap, I'm going to die. Like, my mind's racing. I can't suck my own ankle. I wonder if the guy from Google will do it, like, in the emergency. I'm horrified that my kids will have lost their mother in an accident like this, because they're gonna be like, why didn't she just suck her own ankle? And they're going to go, she couldn't reach her ankle. My kids are going to be like, what? She went to yoga for 18 years. And that's when my secret will come out. I have yoga pants. I've never been to yoga. Every Saturday morning, I tell my kids I'm going to yoga, but I don't. I go to the club and drink Bloody Marys. It's all going to come out. I'm walking forward, and I'm terrified, and I get up there, and I see that that's just a rope off somebody's saddlebag. What caused my pain? My reality or my story? How often do you turn ropes into snakes? I know, because I research it 2.5 hours a day, and then all the work around that. So here's the good news. Your natural state, after you ask questions like, what do I know for sure, and get out of low self into high self, and you stop believing everything you think, your natural state is innovation, collaboration, accountability, engagement. All the things that you want to be, you already are. It's your natural state once the drama's gone. Michelangelo, after he carved David, was asked if carving David was hard, and he said, no, it wasn't hard. I just removed from the marble everything that was David. Or I'm sorry, everything that wasn't David. I just took away everything that wasn't David from the marble. And here's my message I want you to walk away with today. We're not broken. We don't need to get trained on how to become something. I don't need to train you on how to be innovative. I don't need to train you on how to be collaborative. I don't need to train you on how to be accountable. It is your natural state. Once you're in high self and the drama's gone, you already are these things. That's the problem with leadership, is we're trying to fill the gap for people. Training, we're trying to train them on something they already are. But when you're in low self, I don't care how many classes you take, you won't be it. Because your ego will talk you out of it. What would great look like? I'm gonna go be great. The ego says, yeah, but you shouldn't have to. Dang it, I was almost great. See, the ego will take away from you every single time that which you're about to do to be great. And so my hope for you as you think through this, and join me if you want to for the book signing afterwards, is that you really understand that there's a field out there beyond right and wrongdoing. There's a workplace out there. It's spectacular. If this was of interest to you, I'm glad to stay a little bit extra and take some questions, but if this is of interest to you, I have a wonderful podcast called No Ego. I'm everywhere on social media at Cy Wakeman. We have a YouTube show that a lot of people love, Life's Messy, Live Happy. And if you text the word reality to the number 96,000, you'll get an opt-in, and we will let you know when new things come out each week. And we're pretty abundant. We believe in abundance, so we give it all away. You can take it home to your people. Even this keynote is out there on YouTube. Any questions? We're stopping. Do we have time for a question, or do you want to go? Well, let's go. Okay. I will see you in the bookstore.